Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hey, welcome to this week's episode of the Money Tree Investing Podcast. I am Miranda Marquette, and today I have Jack Bosch with me. But before we get into our interview with Jack on how to create cash flow for life, first of all, we've kind of talked about our sponsor real quick. Are you looking for a better way to invest through market turmoil? Consider Betterment. Betterment is a robo-advisor that uses modern portfolio theory to help you manage your portfolio and reach your financial goals. With Betterment, you don't have to worry about what the market is doing on a day-to-day basis. Instead, use the stock market to help consistently build wealth. For more information, visit moneytreepodcast.com/Betterment. I use Betterment to manage my own retirement fund and my travel fund, but that doesn't mean it's right for you. Do your due diligence. Head on over to moneytreepodcast.com/Betterment. All right. Now that that's out of the way, we are going to turn to Jack. So hi, Jack. Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me, Miranda. I'm excited to be here.
Let's first of all talk about the importance of generating cash flow for life. I mean, you know, a lot of people, when they think about investing or they think about their assets, they think about building them up gradually over time and then having retirement and then just taking things from their retirement account. So why do you take this cash flow for life approach?
So I believe there is potentially something wrong, or not wrong, but there's like a little error in people's thinking, or people have been thinking one way, exactly the way that you have mentioned, that the general thinking that has been encouraged also by the industry and by the media and so on is that you work until you're 65, you put 10% of your money off to the side, if possible, 10%, right? Most people put less out. And ideally, once you're 65, you have built enough what I call a pile of money. You have built a pile of money that's big enough that you can that you can start drawing from it, and along with Social Security and things like that, you hope that you can outlive it. So that's what I call the pile of money theory. However, when I came to this country, I'm from Germany, and I started learning how things work over here, and not that it's anywhere different than Germany, it's exactly the same thing there, I realized that, oh my God, I entered a job that I didn't enjoy. So I started questioning the conventional wisdom out there. And what I basically realized, particularly once I came across real estate as my vehicle for wealth generation, I realized that there is a different way. And the different way is what you mentioned, cash flow. Because when you have enough cash flow, when you build up whichever source you use, doesn't even have to be real estate, if you have enough cash flow long-term, lifelong, ideally cash flow built up, that it replaces your income, you can stop working right there and then, no matter if you are 25, 35, 45, 55, or 65. So it takes that time piece out of the equation, and you don't no longer have to be 65 to retire. You can retire whenever your cash flow exceeds your expenses.
Yeah, and I like that point that you make. A lot of the time when we think about cash flow, we think about all of our sources of income, whether it's like from our job, and like you mentioned, you didn't like your job. I'm fortunate. I like what I do. I work from home as a writer and a podcaster, so it's nice for me. But you're talking more about cash flow as in cash flow that you get from your investments, right, whatever those investments might be. So it's not just the cash flow from your job. It is building up sources of cash flow outside your job to get to the point where you no longer rely on that job for your cash flow.
Exactly right. I actually don't even look at job cash income as cash flow, because my definition of cash flow is that it comes in without you working for it. And we actually, my wife and I, we have come up with our own family terminology. We call job income one-time cash. So we call it basically cash that comes in one time only. Now, people say, well, Jack, I get paid every week or every 2 weeks or every month. It's like, yeah, but try not to show up at work for a week unexcused and see how long that check keeps coming in.
Right.
So it's really not cash flow. It's a cash payment for work delivered, for hours spent, for an effort done. And that's one-time cash. What ultimately, and Michelle and I, we actually wrote a book about it called Forever Cash. What we actually focus on the cash flow that we're propagating is cash flow that we're promoting is cash flow that you don't work anymore for, and that comes in for the rest of your life. And that is really from your investments. And that could be dividend stocks, it could be business investments, royalties, or our chosen path, which is real estate investments.
Yeah. So let's talk about that a little bit. How have you been able to get that kind of cash flow moving along with your real estate investing? How have you been able to do that?
Right. So we actually went down a path for that. And if I perhaps can take a moment to explain that path. First, when we came, my wife is from Honduras, Central America. I'm from Germany. When we came to the United States, we really didn't have any cash or any cash flow or any assets or any savings. And so the first thing we needed to do is build up some cash, right? So I had a job, and the job paid me monthly enough to pay my bills and pay for our rent and pay for our car payment and things like that. But then there was nothing left over. So the first thing we realized is we needed some what we now call one-time cash. So we needed to get out of, we had student debt, we have credit card debt, we then subsequently bought our first house. So we had mortgage debt, we had car debt, we had all the typical debt that you can think of. So the first thing was like, okay, how do we kind of get our neck above water so that we even have money to invest in something, whatever that may be? So what we started in real estate is something that it's called land flipping. So instead of flipping houses, like most people watch TV and they see like flip this house and flipping Vegas and flipping whatever it is, we looked at another asset class, which is completely overlooked by the masses. Yet you can do the exactly same thing. You can flip land the same way you can flip houses, just, that's the good news, without the house on it. So therefore, there's no tenants, toilets, termites. There's nothing to improve. We didn't have any real estate experience, so we didn't know how much it costs to replace a kitchen or to repair a roof. And if you just have a piece of land that was worth, let's say, $30,000, and you can buy it for $3,000, and you sell it for $15,000, well, that's a wholesale transaction, as it's called in real estate, but it's a very, very low-risk wholesale transaction, because if you get something at 10 or 20 cents on a dollar, you can flip it quickly at half price. Everyone is happy in the transaction. So we stumbled into that, and nobody was teaching it. We kind of figured it out ourselves. And then we started flipping these pieces of land. And soon enough, we were starting to make $5,000 profits, $10,000, $20,000 profits. And quickly, within 10 months, we were out of debt. And we had a year's worth of living expenses sitting on the sideline. And at that point, we also realized that flipping still won't ultimately make you financially independent. It just creates a bigger pile, right? And that's actually fine as long as you keep that pile growing. But then you're still hoping that you outlive it later on.
Right.
So we realized we need to get into cash flow. And it happened just then that one of our buyers of a piece of land was a piece of land on the outskirts of town, kind of in the path of growth, was worth about $20,000. We had literally bought it for like $3,000. They said, I would love to buy this property, but I don't have $20,000. Could I make a 20% down payment, basically give you a $4,000 down payment and make monthly payments over the course of the next few years and pay it off this way? And we're like, okay, why not? We didn't even know that was possible back then. We had so little knowledge of real estate. So we did that, and all of a sudden we started generating cash flow from an asset class that most people don't think you can generate cash flow, which is land. So we started selling these lands with owner financing, these pieces of land with owner financing. So we started getting $400 a month from this guy for like the next about 8 years. And we're like, well, that's nice. And soon enough, within a few months, we built that up to $5,000 a month. And that actually was more than I was making my job. That even though we had the flipping made us able to pay off our debt and build some cash on the sideline, it's the cash flow that made us then confident to quit our jobs. So we quit our jobs because at this point, $5,000 was more than I'm making in my job. And I was like, if I could do this full time, I could crank this up much more. And I felt comfortable quitting the job because my next monthly mortgage payment, my next monthly rent payment, my next monthly car payment, all was covered by these monthly payments that people were sending us for these owner financing or land deals.
Okay, so you talk about owner financing, and we've talked a little bit about investing in raw land and selling it, kind of like what you did, first of all, to build your cash pile. We've talked about it in the past, but we haven't really talked about owner financing. And this is something that really interests me, because how do you reduce your risk, right? What happens if the person who buys, they don't pay? Do you find another buyer for that land? Or how do you kind of reduce your risk? How do you know that you're going to find somebody who will make those payments for the next 8 years or 10 years or however long?
Sure. Yeah, we have some payments that are for 3 years. We have some for 15 years. The premise behind the scenes is, when you do owner financing, you can owner financing anything. You can owner finance a car, you can owner finance a house, you can owner finance a business, you can owner finance a piece of land. It's just, there's no law in the country that says that you have to use a bank loan. If the seller is willing to let you pay it off in monthly installments, then anything can be sold pretty much with owner financing. So what makes our method so powerful is the fact that in land, you're dealing with, particularly in the land, the land we're dealing with is typically lots worth about $10,000 to $100,000. Most of these pieces of land, first of all, are owned free and clear by the owners. So the owners sitting on them, many of them owned them for like 20, 30 years. They no longer want to pay. They have been paying property taxes every year, and they don't want to pay these property taxes anymore. They're not interested in these lots anymore. So they're willing to give those properties to us very, very cheap. So that's one of the premises that makes this work really beautifully. So they give these properties to us literally between 5 and 25 cents on a dollar. So we take a $40,000 property. We pay anywhere between, let's say, $3,000 and $10,000 for that property. So when we do this the right way, let's say if you take the other day we bought a property for that worth $30,000, we bought it for $3,100. So when we sell this property, we always try to get a down payment that is equal to or higher to what we paid for the property in the first place. So when we do that, we literally get all the money back that we paid for the property right when we sell it. So if we paid $3,100 for a property and we get a $4,000, in this case, we got a $5,500 down payment. So if we get a $5,500 down payment, we already have more money in the pocket than we even started with. And now we have that person send us monthly payments of, let's say, $350 for the next 10 years or 12 years on this loan. And if they stop paying, the worst case can happen is the payments go from $350 to zero. We have to wait a little bit, then we foreclose on them, which there's plenty of inexpensive attorneys and that can help you with that. It might cost, depending on which state it is, anywhere between $200 and let's say $1,000 or $1,500 the most to foreclose on that. But if that person has paid you for a year, they paid you $4,000 already. Now you spend, let's say $1,000 to foreclose on the high end, and then you go sell it right away again. And when you sell it again, you get another $5,000 down payment. And the payments start again. So it's really a no-risk proposition, because as long as you get the initial down payment to be in the vicinity of what you paid for the property or very close to it, it's an infinite return game almost, like, because you have all your money back. It's only profits that you're receiving.
When you do this, I assume you have to set an interest rate. What kind of rates do you tend to set? Like, how do you decide what kind of interest rate to charge your buyers when you're doing an owner finance? Like, how do you decide that? How does that work out?
So there's two ways to do this. There's one way is the traditional way, and the traditional way is to vet the buyer properly and have the buyer fill out a credit application and check their credit scores and all this kind of things. And that's fairly labor intensive. So what we instead do is we adjust, because of what I said earlier, that we really, if they give us a high enough down payment, we really have no money in the deal, because on top of it, if you do it our way, you can even buy the property and sell the property in the same day using the buyer's money, so that if the buyer brings in $5,500 to the table and you have to pay $3,100, the buyer's $5,500 is being used to pay the seller and the difference goes to you. So you don't even need any money in the process. But for the interest rate, what we're doing is we're doing it rather in a way that we adjust to the risk. So if somebody gives us a very low down payment, let's say we have to pay $3,100 for the property, we're selling it for $30,000, and we're only getting $1,000 down, then obviously we're still out $2,000. $1,000 is not a whole lot as a down payment. So this person, we will charge a higher interest rate than somebody that comes and says, I want to put down $5,500 or $10,000 as a down payment. That person will charge a much lower interest rate. So the interest rate, really, it's because you are the bank, you get to choose whichever they are. We typically charge between 8 and 12% interest, because again, in the land area, it's very common to charge higher interest rates. Even banks charge higher interest rates. But we have students now, since we teach this also to others, we have students that charge 6% interest, others charge 14% interest. It's really all around, it's a wide range. But the best way to do it, in my opinion, is just make it dependent on how much they put down as a down payment. If somebody gives me $5,500, I'm pretty darn sure that they're not going to walk away from that loan. So therefore, my risk is lower, and risk and interest rate is reflected as a reflection of risk. So therefore, I might give that to him with a 7 or 8% interest rate. And if they want that same property with a $500 or $1,000 down payment, I might charge them 12 or 13% interest.
So it really is like just kind of a matter of, you know, using your judgment and kind of figuring out what's going to work out best and give you, you know, give you a better chance of making sure that you don't end up losing money on the deal.
Right. And again, the best way to prevent losing money on the deal is to get the down payment that's equal or higher than what you paid for the property in the first place.
Okay. Yeah. So now, when we're talking about this, and you're talking about this as like cash flow, you know, how labor intensive is this? I mean, you talked about like trying to reduce the amount of work you're doing to get this cash flow going. So do you kind of have it systemized? Do you have systems in place to like reduce the amount of actual effort and labor you put into this?
There's automations that you can do in the process of actually finding these properties. So our system relies on direct mail. So we send out very low amounts of direct mails. Many of our students send like 100 letters a week or so, or 200 letters or 300 letters every 2 weeks or so. And they're getting a constant stream of deals that way. What they do, though, is we have relationships with a mailing house that sends the letters for you. We have relationships with a call center that takes the phone calls for you. And then the work part is really kind of spending a little time on your computer figuring out what these properties are worth. There's a very clear structure that we teach our students on how to figure out the value, which is once you're used to it, it takes like 5 minutes to figure out the value of a property. Then you make your offer. And then on the selling side, there's a little bit of things involved, but even that can be outsourced potentially to a really good real estate agent. So we have lots of students that work with good real estate agents. So you can automate or outsource almost all of the steps except for really like kind of like two steps, which is analyzing the property value and deciding what offer to make. Everything else, what dollar amount to offer, everything else can really be outsourced here. Then once you have a seller financing deal, for example, all the other work can be done by title companies. Just like when you buy a house, you don't buy it yourself. You don't do the title work yourself. You don't draw up the documents yourself. You hire a title company or a title attorney for that. And it's the same thing here. On the buying and the selling side, you use title attorneys, title companies, and they do the work for you. And then if you have a seller financing deal, you actually use a loan servicing company to collect the payments for you and do the follow-up and all these different things. So it really can be done almost completely hands-off.
Okay, very cool. All right, well, thank you so much for sharing a little bit of insight in this other way of generating cash flow for life. I think our panel discussion that will follow this later will actually probably look at some other ways that you can generate cash flow for life beyond real estate. But this is a really interesting look at how to do this with land and to kind of get that cash flow going. So thank you so much for joining us. Will you please tell our listeners where they can find you online?
Absolutely. You can find us on www.landprofitgenerator.com. We also have a Facebook. I'm on Facebook. We have a Facebook group where a lot of the people that do this real estate method are hanging out. And also on our website, orbitinvestments.com, we talk about other things because ultimately we make money in land, but then we also invest it in additional cash flow sources like apartment complexes. So we buy larger apartment complexes, we syndicate them with the help of investors and provide them a great return. And so my wife and I life is all about cash flow, generating cash flow.
Here we are, the panel portion of our show. Before we get started, have you ever wondered if there was a better way to avoid the stress of a volatile market? One way is to let the robots handle it. Betterment offers a better way to invest using the time-tested principles of modern portfolio theory. Answer a few questions about your financial goals and how much risk you can handle, and Betterment will construct a portfolio designed to help you build consistent wealth. I use Betterment to grow my retirement portfolio and even meet my short-term travel needs. That doesn't mean it's right for you. Do your research at moneytreepodcast.com/Betterment to figure out if it's the right move for you. And the right move for us this week is having Joe and Kirk to join us on the Money Tree Investing Podcast. So thanks so much for being here. We missed you last week, Joe. What's happening?
Traveling the world, you know, Jess Sutter here.
Nice. Well, I hope you had a good trip.
Actually, I didn't go anywhere. We were moving to a new apartment, and of course, that always makes things infinitely more fun for the week.
Well, hey, you're in a new place. Awesome. And how about you, Kirk? You've been traveling. I know you've been on a trip. So did you have a good trip?
Yeah, we were on vacation. That was pretty nice. We got out of the city to go to an area with more snow. I'm not sure that was necessarily a good thing, but considering it's, I don't know what it is today, it's 12 degrees, I think snow is probably a welcome sign rather than just the bitter cold.
There you go. I mean, you got to take what you can get. We thought it was warming up here. We got all the way up into the mid-30s, and now it's snowing again. So it is what it is. But let's talk about things that we can control. We cannot control the weather, but we can control our cash flow. This was kind of an interesting look at cash flow to me. What did you think about Jack's view of cash flow? Kirk, I mean, do you kind of agree with the idea that cash flow has to be something that you don't earn, or do you look at it all as coming in and going out?
So what I really liked about what Jack was talking about was how he was looking at it, you know, and the language he was using to describe it, which I think is really important, because I think a lot of investors have a very traditional mindset about cash flow. As he pointed out, they look at it as, well, I earn an income, that's cash flow. Well, it is cash flow. And, you know, he uses different words to differentiate it, and I think that's important. But I look at it as money's money. It's all green. It's not, you know, one part of cash flow is no different from the other. I love his way of doing it because I haven't heard anybody who did it the way he's done it before. But I think in terms of the way we look at it is, when we're working with clients, we're looking at where's their income coming from? You know, how can we get them a passive income source for the, you know, the people who are obviously looking for that? But how can we get them that passive income source? Because at some point, some people do retire. You know, some people don't. They continue to work and that's what they love to do. But I think all of us would love to have financial freedom, and that requires having passive income. So there is a definite difference, but I don't necessarily look at it that way. I think everyone, you know, if you do what you love, you know, you're earning money from it, that's cash flow as well.
Yeah, I like that idea. I mean, it doesn't have to be like one idea of cash flow. What do you think of as cash flow, Joe? What's your take on it?
Sure. I loved his idea of, you know, making that break from that traditional working to Social Security and then making nothing for the rest of your life. Building those income sources is important. I kind of disagreed with him a little bit on maybe, I guess, his definition of passive income or cash flow that he was talking about. You know, his flipping strategy sounded like a lot of work. So not necessarily what I would consider passive, but just building up those little businesses online. You know, the internet age is a great opportunity to build up little businesses like, you know, some of the ones that I imagine we'll talk about today, because you can make upwards of, and I'm sure Kirk has the number handy. What is it, like $7,000 a year while you're collecting Social Security and not have it cut into your checks? So, you know, it's a great opportunity to have, you know, even something that's only making maybe $500 a month, really increase the amount that you can live on in retirement.
Yeah, so that's an interesting thought too. I mean, when you think about it, I mean, we talk about living in retirement, you talk about that three-legged stool, that Social Security, your retirement account, and then possibly a pension. I mean, really, I guess like nobody has a pension anymore. And so it's starting to like look more like a balancing act for people. And I kind of think that maybe that pension part of the three-legged stool, you know, we talk about, you know, your 401k, your Social Security, maybe that pension leg of that three-legged stool is going to start looking more like developing other cash flow and developing passive income or those business incomes or those other revenue streams that can kind of help prop you up, if that makes sense. Do you folks see that changing? Do you two see something coming that's a shift in how we look at maintaining our finances as we get older?
Yeah, I could speak to that a little bit. I mean, I think what Joe was saying was accurate in many ways, that what Jack was talking about was a lot of work. I wouldn't call what he was doing passive. I would say that's just another business. I think one of the things that we as an economy are going to experience is a lot of dramatic shifts over the next decade or so. As technology progresses and people's jobs get minimized due to technology and commoditization and what have you, we've certainly seen a rise in the gig economy, you know, in the last 10 or so years. And that, I think, is just going to increase because, you know, as the millennials really like that type of work, they like doing gigs and they like the flexibility. And certainly I like it too. You know, my generation growing up, I mean, we pretty much, we just work hard. It's two parent households. Everyone's working, just trying to keep up with, you know, with everything. And I find that a lot more people are coming to us and saying, hey, I want another income source. I want to flip houses on the side, or I want to, you know, do something on the side to generate extra income because everything is so darn expensive. And I don't see that changing. I mean, it's not as if all of a sudden prices are going to drop 50% and now all of a sudden we can afford everything. So there's big trends in that area. And I think a lot of people are just looking for additional ways to earn income. And I think if it's passive, that's great. But there aren't too many passive sources of income. Even real estate's not passive. You still got to work the property. You still have, it's still work. So the quote unquote passive sources are actually relatively few because, you know, it all requires work. I mean, if it was that easy, everyone would do it.
Yeah, I like this idea of requiring work and what is really passive. I mean, what about you, Joe? What do you think of as passive? And you know, you talked a little bit about the flipping strategy seemed like a lot of work. And we talk about passive income from investments or passive income from other sources. How passive do you think anything really is? I mean, even when you're running a website, right, you still have to like make updates, you still have to be involved. Is there any really truly passive income out there?
Sure. And it's a question I see a lot on the YouTube channel. I talk about investing a lot and people are always talking about passive income from that, especially with dividend stocks. And I really don't consider it passive income because, you know, you had to work to earn that money in the first place. With other passive income ideas, you know, I mean, I could call something passive such as that investing idea if, yeah, you do it once, maybe you earn the money once, and then it creates a return or creates cash flow beyond that. So for example, I would include things like self-publishing, books, creating an affiliate funnel. So not necessarily something like maybe a blog where you have to continuously update the blog and create content, but creating a funnel that can basically be put on autopilot with maybe an email series or something like that. I'd consider that about as passive as you're going to get. You know, you're still going to have to do that initial work. You're still going to have to develop that side of the business, I guess I'd say, as far as a blog. So it has that momentum to keep making you money, because even a blog, as much work as it, continuous work as it involves, you can still build up that momentum to where, you know, you could stop for a few months and it's still going to make you money. So there's definitely a scale there, a continuum from daily work to completely passive.
I like the way you defined it, Joe, of having a, you know, you work one time and then it's passive. The way I think of passive income are things like bonds or dividend stocks or, you know, some sort of fixed income where you're putting money down and it's producing income. And that could take different sources. You mentioned self-publishing. I think it's a great way to look at it, because if you're doing it once and it's going to keep paying you income over time, effectively that is passive income. It really comes down to how we look at it. Because, you know, running a business, that's certainly income, but it's not passive. But you can invest in a business as passive income. You know, you could invest in a, you know, local dry cleaner and it gives you, you know, whatever, $10,000 a year in income. Like, you can do things like that. But if you're running the shop, then it's not passive. It's just more of a mindset perspective of how are you investing? Are you investing as an investor or are you investing as a business owner? And then how much continuous work do you have to put it into? So I think it's a great perspective.
Sure. And I think a lot of it comes down to how you manage it. Just like you rightly said, you know, any business can be passive if you're completely outsourcing the management on it. So, I mean, I guess we get into, you know, tax definitions of passive income, or, but yeah, you know, I mean, you can create a passive income source. So it just depends on how you approach it, I guess.
What really struck me about, you know, when he's talking about like finding that you can get for pennies on the dollar and be a seller, like kind of be the seller financing and everything. It did seem like a lot of work, except for if you outsource it, but it reminded me a lot of like tax liens, honestly. It made me think of Kirk and tax liens, because, you know, it's something kind of similar where you kind of pick something up that's cheaper and then just sort of keep it going. Although if you're not, you know, you're not really, I guess, necessarily seller financing. Well, you are kind of seller financing the tax liens. Anyway, whatever. It made me think about that. But what are some of the other ways that if you want to kind of get that cash flow going or look for passive or passive-ish ways, I guess, not completely passive, but maybe passive-ish ways to earn money. Like, what are some of the other things you can do beyond like real estate or tax liens? What are some things that you guys look at? Joe, do you have something that you think of as a way to do passive-ish income?
Sure. I make money on upwards of 9 income sources on the blogs and the YouTube channel. And I would consider probably really only 2 or 3 passive. You know, the rest are advertising that I have to keep up with, constantly seeking out sponsors and constantly creating content and that kind of thing. But like I mentioned earlier, the two that I'd really consider more passive than others is that self-publishing and then affiliate funnels. So we're really talking about something that you can set up once, upload to a platform, and maybe set up a process that makes it passive. So obviously self-publishing is a great source for bloggers or anyone already, you know, creating that content, because you're already creating something that you can reformat into a book, put it up on Amazon, which of course is, you know, the largest e-commerce site in the world. And you can put together an advertising system where maybe you're spending maybe 20 or 30 bucks a book each month. What you can do, you can create enough sales, enough organic traffic that will kind of spur that Amazon algorithm, basically the ranking system, and keep your books ranked. So that's really all you have to do. And you automate those ads and the books just keep selling based on that system. With affiliate funnels, I think a lot of people jump into affiliate marketing, where basically you partner with a company to get a link, put that link somewhere, whether it be a blog or a social media post. If someone clicks on it and then buys the product, then you get a commission. And the problem here is, of course, that you need massive amounts of traffic to make any sales on those. Whereas an affiliate funnel, you create 2 or 3 blog posts talking about a broader topic, maybe a problem that people will have, in which this affiliate or this product fits. And then you create, you know, some kind of a free handout, like it's called a lead magnet, basically. That's going to be something that people can download when they give you their email address. And with that, you put them on a special email list that goes out maybe 2 or 3 emails, very short. And it just kind of talks up these posts that you put together. And then eventually it talks up this affiliate. And there's software out there like ConvertKit, which is an email service provider, that you can basically automate all of this. So you have these 3 posts that are getting traffic from Google, getting traffic from social media. People visit those. They see this freebie, this handout, or this checklist, which they sign up for and get put into this email list that goes out over, you know, over maybe a week. And then that just creates that relationship, that deeper relationship, and creates you as a trusted resource to where they trust you a little bit more, and they're ready, you know, it guides them through that buying decision process for whatever that product is. And so, yeah, if you can put this on autopilot, really, and it really becomes passive income, because you set it up and it continuously works with that email sequence. So those are probably the 2 income sources that I use the most, or that are the most passive. And simply because it might take a month to set either of these up, to write a book or set up this funnel. So they're much more intense, much more detailed than a lot of other strategies. But what's 1 month when something is going to be lasting for a year, 2 years, 3 years, and bringing in income, rather than having to constantly spend 5 or 6 hours a week, every week doing it?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And it's something that I think that I've been thinking about a lot this year is, you know, I try and like cycle out, like with the freelancing. I mean, I love the writing, I love the freelancing, I love doing it, but it's something I have to do, right? It is definitely not passive. And so, you know, I'm looking for ways to add a little more passivity into my revenue streams. What about you, Kirk? What are some of the things that you think of as ways to kick up that passive income, get a little more cash flow that maybe you don't have to spend a lot of time working on?
Yeah. You know, I love Joe's approach. I think it's great if you have the background or the willingness to do that. I know a lot of people have been very successful in that approach. I think more of a traditional investor approach, meaning I'm looking at assets that are going to spin off cash or cash flow through different avenues, things that I don't have to actually do the work up front. So doing the work up front, obviously, we have to research it and make sure it's a good investment. But taking that aside, and that is work. But taking that aside, I'm looking for things that are going to consistently spin off cash. And, you know, there are many traditional ways, which I think a lot of people know, like CDs or bonds or dividends from stocks. We also look at other things too. I mean, you can obviously look at real estate for rent. You know, the concept of what Jack had talked about, which is effectively seller financing. So effectively, you're kind of loaning out money, expecting it to some extent that you're probably going to get the property back, and you're just going to take that approach. Some people do lease options, so they'll buy properties, they'll lease it to somebody, and then, you know, if they buy it from them eventually, they'll pay them an extra amount as an option. So it's an interesting strategy, which doesn't always work, because if the real estate market is too hot, which has generally been, it's really hard to do that. But lease options is something I've always been interested in, because you can generate multiple streams of revenue just from one property. So with real estate, there are a lot of different interesting ways to do it. Some people will loan money, like private mortgages or hard money, as some people call it. You know, if somebody needs to borrow money to renovate a property, they usually go for hard money lenders, and you can make, you know, decent rates there. Tax liens is another one, which, you know, we talked about in the last few weeks, which is obviously my favorite asset. That's a great way to generate some pretty good income. And then there's other weird asset classes like royalties. You know, if you think about royalties, you can buy, this is becoming a little bit more mainstream, but, you know, let's just say Hollywood decides to package up a bunch of song rights to certain, you know, older songs. And they package it up into a pool, and they sell the pool, and they get, you know, royalties from that. And let's say the royalties are, I don't know, like 10% or whatever it might be. You're getting that continuously. And for some people, it makes a lot of sense, because they understand the asset, and they know that people are going to continually need that asset. That's a really interesting one that we're looking at. It's still relatively new, and there's still a lot of things that need to be worked out in that asset, meaning like who's going to manage it and things like that. But there are a lot of really interesting strategies out there that people have used to generate income. Another one is tax credits, motion picture film tax credits. A lot of people invest in those. So there's a lot of cool ideas out there. And I think that the more creative you can be with your investing strategy, the easier it is to come up with some of these ideas. Because the real estate one, I mean, I could probably come up with 10 ideas of creating additional revenue streams from real estate just by thinking outside the box. And I think that's what Jack was kind of getting at. Even though what he was doing sounds like an actual job, the idea of doing some of those things are really fascinating. And I know some people that do that professionally. And actually, before I forget, one more, is people buy discounted notes, discounted paper. So let's say there's like a mortgage out there, and somebody doesn't want to hold it anymore, so they buy it for a discount, and they get some pretty good income from it. And that might be a mortgage, it might be insurance settlements. Oh, actually, this is a good one. I almost forgot. This is one that not many people know about. You can actually buy lottery winning income streams. Some people do this on life insurance, and some people do it on lottery winnings. But effectively, if you win the lottery and you decide, I'm getting 20 years of cash flow, you're going to get paid out over 20 years as opposed to a lump sum, then what somebody can do is they can go out on the market and say, I want to get paid right now. I don't want to wait 20 years. So somebody like me, let's say, would go in and say, all right, I'm going to pay you $1 million for $2 million of income over the next 20 years. They'll say, okay, great, I'll take it. And over 20 years, I'll get $2 million. The difference in that, in those numbers, would be my interest or kind of my income from that. So it's a way to finance cash flow streams, which is really popular on the institutional level. On the individual level, it's harder to do, because they are generally harder to find. And there are some issues with that, meaning like you have to, these things are actually legal documents. Like if I win the lottery and I sell my lottery winnings to Joe, my rights, I have to go to court to assign my rights to make sure that they're legally binding. So that there is some extra effort involved, but it's cash flow. And, you know, there are people out there who make good money doing it. So there are a lot of ways to do it if you're creative. So I would say that, you know, if you have assets that you really love, to think creatively about it. And I'm sure you can come up with some ways to generate cash flow from it.
And one of the things that I've been looking at beyond, you know, those kinds of things is just sort of building up my dividend portfolio. One of the things I noticed way back in the day, when I first started investing and was just investing in like a retirement account, I noticed that going through the recession and the stock market downturn, I noticed that, you know, I was getting like dividends in my retirement portfolio. So I thought, well, let's look into this and see if I can put those in a taxable account as well and create kind of a source of income. So there are lots of different ways you can look to do that. I mean, building a dividend portfolio over time, it takes some time unless you have a nice big chunk of capital immediately. It does take some time to move forward and build that up. But I'm kind of toying with that right now and building a dividend portfolio, which is a little bit outside of my general comfort zone of indexing. But, you know, I thought it would be a way to build that up for the future. Are there other things like that that you guys think about?
I mean, in the investing space, there's a lot of great cash flow investments. I would point to, you know, besides dividend stocks, REITs, which we've talked about before on the podcast. There's a real estate investment trust, and are a little bit different kind of real estate company. It's basically a professional real estate company that holds real estate and is set up under a special tax code to really return most of its cash flow to investors to avoid double taxation, that corporate tax. So those are definitely a must for anyone that needs that real estate exposure, but also for cash flow. But also I'd say master limited partnerships, which are kind of the REIT side of the energy space. So these are companies that are set up specifically to hold pipelines, to hold energy storage facilities, and so forth. And again, it's a special tax code, or a special part of the tax code that lets them avoid corporate taxes if they return most of their cash flow to investors. It's a great way to get a little bit higher cash flow. I mean, these MLPs offer yields usually around 5 or 6%. Now, one caveat there is they do issue a special tax form each year because you're technically a partner in this business. So they issue a K-1 partnership form. Makes taxes a little bit more difficult, but fairly easy to get around once you know what boxes to fill out.
Yeah, I like that. There are lots of different ways to kind of get that cash flow going and get that cash flow moving, for the rest of your life and kind of build that up. But like we've discussed, it does take some time and it does take a little bit of effort to make that work. Kirk, final words for you on the idea of cash flow.
Yeah. So I guess to take off Joe's point, I think, you know, when it comes to the traditional markets, if somebody's so inclined to stay in the traditional side of things, there are a lot of ways to invest for quote unquote cash flow. I think the question is how much work you have to put in. As Joe said, REITs and MLPs, I love MLPs given the right environment. They are a pain in the butt when it comes to K-1s. I get a lot of people are complaining about K-1s and I say, well, you're making money. So yes, it's a little extra work. And if you're filing your own taxes, it's probably a pain, but it's income that you're getting with a tax preferred treatment. You know, it's complicated, but effectively you're paying fewer taxes on the income and it just lowers your cost basis over time. And it's a phenomenal investment. It's always been one of my favorites from a tax perspective. REITs, I'll take REITs a step further because I think most people think of real estate. There are actually things called mortgage REITs, which I'm a big fan of, and the yields end up being higher. And obviously you have to know what you're doing because these are more complex instruments, but given the right environment, they're fantastic investments if you do your diligence. I also like preferred stocks, another kind of odd duck area that most people don't know much about, but they're not quite bonds and they're not quite stocks. It's kind of like a hybrid of the two. A lot of them produce good income, higher than you probably find in most corporate bonds. You know, the risk is definitely higher, but if you're looking for income and you can do your diligence well enough, it's a great source for finding good investments. Dividend stocks are great. I prefer to invest in dividend stocks that are increasing their dividends every year because it just shows that their company's growing and they have the right mindset about things. So for me, that's really important, but you do have to watch out for the company's underlying fundamentals, because I think the longest running stock that had a increase in dividends every year over year was like, I don't know, it was like 50 or 60 years. And I think in the last 2 years, they had to actually change that because they just couldn't support it with their own cash flow. So you have to watch out for that.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I mean, I look at Dividend Aristocrats a lot because they've increased over, you know, every year for 25 years. But I think you're right that you do have to be careful. Past performance does not guarantee future results.
And the last one I'll say is option selling. I know this is probably beyond most people because it's a lot more complex and requires a lot more work. But covered call writing or things like that is a great way to generate extra income off of positions that you already own. Now, obviously, this comes with risk, and if you don't know what you're doing, you shouldn't do it. But I've found that if you put in a little time to understand the risks and the rewards, you know, it tends to be a really great source of being able to produce extra income for you for positions that you already own. But with options, obviously, comes risk, and you need to understand what you're getting into. But yeah, I mean, those on the traditional side are some of my more favorite asset classes to consider.
Yeah. So speaking of things to consider, we do have something cool going on right now. We've got a $50 Amazon gift card we're giving away here in the month of March and also until April 15th. So it's our March Madness that's extended until tax day. So it's a little bit of fun. We are making some changes here at the Money Tree Investing Podcast. So we do have a survey that we would love for you to fill out. Also, if you want to sign up for our newsletter, you can get two entries for the drawing to get that $50 Amazon gift card. So you get two entries into the drawing if you sign up for our newsletter and fill out the survey. That link is moneytreepodcast.com/email. And then you'll also be able to fill out a survey. And when you do both of those things, you will get two entries into our drawing, which will take place in the middle of April. We'll be accepting entries until April 15th. That is tax day for those of you keeping track and take the survey. We want to know what you think. We want to know how we can better serve you. And hopefully also you can get up to date on things that are happening, tips, and just another way for you to keep up to date with what's going on with the Money Tree Podcast. So make sure you sign up for that email list and that you fill out the survey so that you are in our drawing. Thank you so much for joining us. Remember that you can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, on Google Play, on Spotify, and on Stitcher. Also, check out moneytreepodcast.com for more information and resources and access to all of our archives and our episodes. So thank you so much. Remember, no one will take care of your money as well as you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.